Yo, what is going on, Fit Story fam? Matthew Burbridge is back in the motherfucking house for another episode. And today, I'm honored to be sharing space with one of the OGs of the fitness world, okay? A nomad who travels full-time, doing really cool shit, taking his teachings with him everywhere he goes. And as we were just saying before we went live, someone who practices what they preach is doing what it is that they are teaching, which is really quite rare these days. So I actually first came across today's guest when a friend of mine told me, you should check this dude out. His name's Steve Maxwell, and you should definitely see some of what he does. I think it was like breathwork techniques and wellness, like general wellness, and juice of jade is something that I started to implement as well, which is really good. And upon my research, I was really able to find that you really are an expert in your field. And that's something that I resonate with, because there is a lot of people out there today, a lot of trainers that are out there just trying to make a quick bit of money. And they are trying to, and they are spouting all sorts of nonsense. They're doing cookie cutter plans for people. Their approach isn't tailored in any way to any individual. And that does not resonate with me. And so if I'm looking to learn from somebody, I want to learn from someone who I know is doing it the right way. That is who you are. You're somebody that is doing good work. You are trying to change the world, and you are doing it. And it's a pleasure, bro, to have you on the show. Steve Maxwell is here.
Thanks, Jamil. I'm happy to be here. Happy to share my story. And hopefully, you know, some of my experiences can help other people. Mm. I don't really consider myself like an expert, but I have had some great mentors. And our knowledge, you know, it's not self-created. It's things that we learn from other people. So we always have to acknowledge our teachers and our mentors. And it's really important, I think, for people to understand that, as you said, cookie cutter pattern, you got to take whatever knowledge that you get from different people and make it fit yourself.
Mm.
There's no such thing as one size fits all.
No.
There are general principles that apply to all human beings. If there wasn't, you know, we couldn't have medical science. People are more alike than different, but there's still, within that alikeness, plenty of variation. Things like, you know, your genetics and your recovery ability. And, you know, of course, people, you know, older, younger, you know, so there's no such thing as one hard and fast rule. And many, many, many things work in the fitness industry. They do. But when looking at many different programs and ideas, I think it's very important to pick the one that's sustainable, the one that is safe, and the one that takes the least amount of time.
Mm.
A lot of people get caught up, you know, 2-3 hours in the gym, which is totally unnecessary, way yep. too much wear and tear in the body yep. over time.
Yeah. It's interesting you say about mentors, because I've had a few really, really good mentors, only a couple. And one of those was a gentleman called Mark Manklow. And he was the first person to kind of introduce me to the idea of stimulus for the muscle in as short a period of time as possible. Don't waste too much time in the gym. And at that time, I remember I was doing like the whole 2-hour workouts. I was reading a lot of fitness magazines, you know, the whole Kai Greene barn door back, you know, door back workouts and all this stuff. And I remember he took me through one of our first sessions, actually, was a complete meltdown of my ego. I'll be really honest, he completely stripped me of any ego that I had in that gym that day, and it changed my entire life. It changed my entire approach to how I viewed bodybuilding and what I was doing. And I don't even think since then I have done a workout with weights resistance that's probably been longer than maybe 40 minutes, if that. And I've managed to achieve stimulus in the muscle and growth from doing shorter sessions that are just more focused on the time under tension versus this crazy idea of me lifting loads of weight with my biceps for
mechanical smoke rent. Yeah, mechanical work versus metabolic work. You know, people get really mixed up. There's a buddy of mine, Jay Vincent, that just recently did a video, and he showed three sets. He just used the bicep curl as an example, but he did three sets, the normal gym way, you know, up and down, with a timer. And then he did one slow high tension set with control, you know, and the one set actually was a much greater time under load than the three set.
Yeah.
It was actually 30 seconds longer.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just don't understand the idea of time under tension.
Yeah.
But I like to backtrack a little bit.
Yeah.
Where I came from.
Yeah.
I started life in a little town called Carlisle, Pennsylvania. There's actually a sister city in North England, Carlisle, England. And a lot of places in the United States had their origins from Great Britain back in the day. I grew up in this little town and I was being bullied. I was kind of basically a little kid that wasn't particularly fit. And my father saw this. And at an early age, he started teaching me and my brother boxing because he saw the older kids were picking on us quite a bit. And then when I was 10, he bought me my first barbell set. And I took to that barbell set. We were just down the...
One with the spindle locks.
Yeah.
I remember the spindle locks.
Yeah. Old school. So, yeah, he bought me the Big 12 Special. Now, this is back in the 60s. You know, now, I mean, people have been lifting for a while, but it still wasn't widely recognized, you know, lifting in those days. And I thought there was a place called the York Barbell Club, which was kind of like the mecca for physical culture, strength training, Olympic lifting. They didn't differentiate between weightlifting and bodybuilding and gymnastics. You know, they borrowed freely from all these different disciplines. They didn't have all these different camps. And I followed the typical courses of the day. And then in those days, the muscle magazines were a little bit different. They weren't quite so hype. You didn't have the rampant drug use. You know, everyone was still pretty natural back in the 60s. The steroids didn't rear their ugly head until mid to late 70s is when they started, you know, coming into play.
It was so around the Pump and Iron movie, right? It was around then.
Yeah, right about the time of Arnold and Franco Colombo and Dave Draper and Lou Ferrigno and there's all, you know, Frank Zane, there's old school bodybuilder. But for me, I wanted to be an athlete. I really was terrible at almost all sports. You know, I wasn't particularly good. I wasn't a real coordinated job. I didn't have a lot of good physical attributes. That's probably one reason why the kids were kicking my ass in the neighborhood, you know. So besides the boxing and the weight training, I realized I had a real knack for wrestling. I went out when I was in the seventh grade. In the States, all the sports programs are run through the local school districts and statewide school districts. It's pretty well organized school sports programs. So I would stay after school and I became a wrestler and I was really good at it. And boy, did I turn the tables and all those bullies.
I can imagine.
A couple of guys got a good thrashing.
Yeah, but they weren't picking on you then.
I went from like one of the weakest kids in school to like one of the strongest. And it's not because I had any great genetics or anything. It's just because I was lifting, you know. And the programs of the day were actually pretty sane by today's standards. You know, they were pretty, you know, you lift 3 days a week. You know, you do one or two sets and, you know, you work hard and you just keep, you know, the old double progression system.
Yeah.
It was, and then of course I tried a bunch of different programs like the 20 rep squat program where you drink a gallon of milk and you do the 20 rep squats, the breathing squats.
Hey, you got to try these things.
I got huge, man. But, you know, unfortunately, because of the huge amount of calories, I gained unwanted body fat for sure.
Yeah.
But,
So just whilst we're on this this part of your story, because I want to just talk a little bit about the influence. Obviously, We've got the motive for why to get involved in that sort of lifestyle with the boxing and stuff. But the influence, you mentioned your father. So was he an athlete? Was he heavy into training? I mean, where does he kind of, because usually it's somebody.
He wasn't a weight trainer, but he was very fit. He worked for the Federal Department of Agriculture. And he was in a supervisory capacity. They had a lot of programs throughout the state where they were forced to walk a lot. Mm. And sometimes he would cover every square foot in certain counties looking for, at that time they were in the rust spreading barberry. This is a barberry bush that is part of a spore cycle. And these spores would like completely damage crops to the farmer. He was a West Virginia farm boy. And he grew up working hard. And I can remember his grip was like insane. And he claimed it was from milking the cows by hand when he was a boy that he developed this insane grip. He wanted to get off the farm in West Virginia. I mean, he was way out in the country. They didn't even have electricity, man. They were still living like the 1800s.
Wow.
You know, they used draft horses to plow the fields. But he desperately wanted to get off the farm. So he joined the Navy in World War II.
Yeah.
When he was underage. And, but they took him and he served in World War II on a destroyer escort in the Pacific. And, he had been boxing from the time he was like 12 years old and he was a damn good boxer. And they used to stage fights in the barn, you know, all the neighborhood farm kids would go in there and beat the tar out of each other.
Cool.
And, so he became the bantamweight, or maybe he's flat. He's a very light guy. He was the Pacific, I believe, bantamweight champ in during World War II. They would get all the ships together, and they would put a ring on one of the battleships or aircraft carriers, and then they would have these tournaments right out in the middle of the water.
That's so cool, man.
And he was the champ of the U.S. Navy, the Navy fleet during.
So it makes sense. It makes sense why boxing. Yeah.
And his hands were good. But yeah. I hated boxing. I hated getting hit. And my brother was pretty good. So, you know, he would get the best of me. So I would get pissed off and throw the gloves off and grab him and take him down. And he says, wait a second, you're not a boxer, you know, but you are a wrestler. And that's when he taught me and I started going out for the wrestling. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, a lot of guys, all they want to do is get big and muscular. My goal was to become the best athlete, the best wrestler I could be. So for me, the weights were a means to an end to become a better wrestler because I knew that by being stronger, it would make me better at my chosen sport.
Did you have a vision at that point to pursue that as not necessarily career, I guess, because I guess then it was probably much harder to imagine yourself doing that as a career. Like today, that's actually not a far shout, is it? People do go into wrestling and say, this is going to be my full-time career. Like I'm going to be a professional wrestler and this is going to be what I do. But back when you were doing it, did you kind of have a vision to pursue it at a certain level? Like where was you at with that?
I knew when I was 12 years old, what I wanted to do with my life because the people I admired most were my physical education instructors and my wrestling coaches. My wrestling coach was also the football coach. And even though I was very small and I wasn't very good, he encouraged me to go out for gridiron football. Soccer didn't exist in the U.S. in those days, but gridiron football was pretty popular. And despite being small, I was actually pretty wiry. And I did okay, but I wasn't great. You know, I just didn't have the size or the speed. But he thought it would just be good for me, you know, as an off-season activity. And because I admired my coaches and my PE teacher so much, I wanted to become a PE teacher. So when I graduated high school, I entered the School of Health and Physical Education at Westchester, PA. And I majored 4 years as a physical education major and then went to grad school afterward. And I got a job in the public school system, coaching wrestling and teaching PE. During my college years, I wrestled NCAA Division I, which is the highest level of wrestling in the U.S., and I had a very successful college wrestling career.
Amazing.
But then I realized, I don't really like working with kids that much.
Go figure.
While I was actually in college, I started working at a gym. It was the first Nautilus gym in Pennsylvania. And it was run by a fellow by the name of Greg Ellis. And he was working on his degree in exercise physiology at the time. And he gave me my first start in 1972 at this Nautilus gym. It's called the Huff and Puff Gym.
Oh, brilliant name.
And I had gone in there to check it out because I had been reading about this crazy guy, Arthur Jones, and his newfangled machines. And I was quite fascinated with the whole thing. And Jones was a very good writer. And I went in a little bit cocky. You know, I'm a wrestler at Westchester, and I consider myself in superb physical shape.
Of course.
You know, yeah. And I had been doing, you know, different types of barbell routines, the typical 5x5, the Bill Starr Big Three, 20 rep squat. You know, I did a lot of different routines. And this guy put me through the single set Nautilus machines and totally destroyed me in under 20 minutes. Wow. I mean, I sat there on the floor for an hour and a half before I had the strength to drive home.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned your ego had been totally destroyed. With it. Yeah,
yes.
But me too.
I resonate. Realized,
holy shit. This is intensity, a whole new level.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people badmouth, you know, machines as being non-functional or high intensity training doesn't work. That's nonsense, man. Mm. It worked. And I had a very successful college wrestling career and was really in superb physical condition. Of course, you know, I was young. And I'm not saying that there's not many programs that work. It all works. It all works the same way. You know?
Yeah.
It basically makes you stronger and more muscular.
Yeah.
But some systems are more conducive to time efficiency.
Of course. And you said it was
kind of only about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I remember going through a first time under tension session really with Mark. And I remember he said, right, we're going to do a bench press. What do you normally do on bench press? I said, well, and it's me again, same as you, you know, I was like quite bulky, quite big, you know, so I had a bit of an ego there too. And I was like, well, I'll do 90 kilograms. Right. And I remember he kind of like looked away from me, like panned away from me as if to say, okay, we'll do your weight for now and see how you get on. And I remember like, I couldn't even lift it for two repetitions under the amount of tension that we were under. And I remember just like, I didn't want to give up. So I was like at the bottom of my chest, I was like really trying to push it to get back up. And he helped it back up. And he said, you got it all wrong. He said, you're going to have to strip this, probably put it down to 10 kilos each side. And I'm thinking, I'm in the gym. Like, this is my train. This is my environment. Like, people are going to see me with 10 kilograms. Oh, and it was one of the best ever workouts I've ever done. Just the same thing as you. Like, afterwards, I just felt emasculated, but also just so like, wow. Like, I felt like I knew so much. And now I've met this mentor and I know nothing. Like, I know literally nothing. It was an amazing moment in my growth, for sure.
I had the same experience. I actually had a guy come in and says that he does 100 push-ups every day.
Mm.
I says, really? I said, that's a lot of push-ups in one set. And he says, yeah. I said, well, show me. And it was the most god-awful push-up you've ever seen, man. I mean, it barely bent his arm. So I took him and I showed him the proper technique and form. He was barely able to get 10 push-ups.
Yeah.
Same thing. Like I was actually in London at a local gym, and there was a young guy, very fit. And of course he had his shirt off to make sure everyone knew it.
Yep.
And he jumped up on the pull-up bar, and I just happened to have my timer running and I timed him out. He did 21 pull-ups, which is pretty impressive actually. You know, but it was like 1 second up, 1 second down. And then the fellow I was training was also very fit. And he jumped up and he did very slow attention rep, about 10 seconds up, a squeeze, 10 seconds down. And he ended up doing about 5.
Yeah.
If you multiply that, you'll see that his time under tension was almost 30 seconds longer than the guy that did 21 reps. The guy that did 21 reps, his time under tension was only about 40 seconds.
Yeah, which is ultimately, like we were saying, that's what matters, because your muscle doesn't know the number. It just understands the load, the tension. That's really the...
Now, did the fast reps work? Of course they worked. And the guy was very muscular and very strong, and he looked great, you know? Did the slow reps work? Of course it worked, you know? My guy was also very muscular and very strong. The difference is the lifetime of wear and tear on the body. See, for the longest time, I didn't understand this, you know, because I got involved with Nautilus, and then eventually I ended up, you know, working in a bunch of different gyms all over the Pennsylvania and the U.S. But I ended up owning my own called Maxercise in 1990.
I did see this. Yeah, you had that for quite some time as well, right?
Yes, with my my ex-wife. It was also the first Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu school on the eastern seaboard of the U.S. That's a whole story into itself, the whole BJJ thing. But at our gym, we had old Nautilus vintage with retrofitted cams for slow high tension reps, hammer strength, and some free weights. And we did that for quite a few years through 1990 through about 98, 99. And that's when I was kind of going through like a little midlife crisis. And I started getting interested in other forms of training, because I just felt like something was missing. There wasn't anything missing.
Yeah,
it was just that I had already reached my genetic limit. And, you know, you don't keep growing, you get bigger forever.
Yeah.
By the time a guy's been training for, you know, 3-4 years, you pretty much hit your limit, you know? You don't have unlimited potential for muscular size and strength. But I started getting more into demonstrating strength, you know, like I did when I was in college. I started getting into heavy, low rep work. And then I read an article in Milo magazine. It was the first time I had heard about Russian kettlebell training. It was written by Pavel Satsolin.
Yeah.
And it was pretty interesting. And I thought, oh, this sounds really fascinating. So I sought Pavel out, and he and I formed the RKC together. We went and met at the Arnold Schwarzenegger trade show in Columbus, Ohio. It's like the biggest fitness show and strong, you know, bodybuilding, strongman, everything. And I met him for dinner with this guy, John Duquesne. And we came up with this idea for the RKC, which was the start of the kettlebell movement in the U.S. And I maxed out a credit card and bought like $10,000 worth of kettlebells.
Wow.
So started doing these kettlebell classes.
This is something that I'd like to unpack a little bit of. Listening to this podcast will be, the audience is a lot of fitness professionals that may be listening for the purpose of going through their journey, but also there's a lot of fitness professionals who are building businesses, and they're doing that through different means. And one of the things that we always talk about is mindset, and we talk about the logistics behind doing certain things. And obviously owning a gym, there seems like there's so much to your story, by the way. I feel like I need to get you back on for like part two, part three, and part four at some point. But owning a gym, quite a tough thing to do, to get moving and to do all those things, but then also reaching out to people and seeking out partnerships like that. Is there any insights you can give about your story in doing that? Like, how did that actually look when you were trying to reach out to those people? What did that actually look like? How did you do that? Like, how did you actually get that done?
Well, the first part, my first job in the fitness industry, I just literally went, did a workout, and then I offered to work for the guy. I was so convinced it was a great way to go. And I realized that they had a small operation, and it was only two guys that were working, and they were working basically 7 days a week trying to make it a go.
Wow.
And, you know, I offered my services to fill in on weekends. And they were really happy because I was a physical education major, and, you know, I understood the philosophy. So that was the foot in the door, so to speak.
Amazing.
And then with that experience and a 4-year college degree, I was able later on then to get, several jobs in different gyms. And I cold called a owner of the Society Hill Club in Philadelphia. I had moved around a bit. I was a bit of a nomad even back then.
And, yeah. Stay big, yeah.
You know, always managed to get a job in a gym somewhere, you know, because I had good credentials. Because in those days, most people, there was no such thing as fitness certifications, you know, but a four-year college degree in exercise science and PE goes a long way to giving you good credentials. So I started a whole strength training program in the city swim club. It was a big pool, and they had squash courts, tennis courts. They had no really nice strength training facility. And I convinced the owner, just went in, just knocked on the door, introduced myself, told him my idea, you know, and he was intrigued. And he hired me, and he gave me a budget. I ordered the equipment. I set it up, and I ran that for many, many years.
Man, that's insane, man.
They went out of business, by the way, because the guy had gambling problems.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, the sheriff came in and locked the doors and put chains and sent everyone. They foreclosed on the guy's mortgage because he wasn't paying his bills, man.
No. But then again,
to all the people working in there, man.
Yeah.
And I found myself out of a job. And I just bought a house. I had just been married. I just had a brand new baby boy. No job. But all those years, I was buying a piece of Hammer strength equipment, one machine at a time. And there's a famous strength trainer. His name is Dr. Ken Leisner. He was in Long Island. He used to change equipment like people change socks and shoes, man. And I would go and buy his old used equipment that he would get rid of. I don't know why. He just kept changing his stuff all the time.
Yeah.
Getting rid of it, buying new stuff. I don't know where he got the money. Part of it was he had part of ownership in Hammer Strength. So I would get his old Hammer Strength stuff, take it apart, put it in my family sedan, and drive it 2 hours back to Philadelphia from New York, take it in my row house basement, and assemble it together. So when the sheriff foreclosed on the old Society Hill Club, I had already had like 12 pieces of Hammer Strength in my basement, plus free weights, dumbbells, one of the Schwinn Airdynes. It's kind of like the assault bike, but it was like the precursor to the assault. You know, I had some stuff.
Yeah.
And I had an old heavy bag, you know, stuff like that.
So this is all what went into the gym, right?
So that was my starter line.
Incredible.
And I happened to have a client that owned a building. And the building was pretty much unrentable space. It was like an old warehouse where they used to have like a clothing. It was like a wholesale clothing warehouse in this very old building. In fact, this building went back to the late 1800s. It was basically a sweatshop. It was like a textile manufacturing building at one point. And it was pretty rough, you know, like exposed beams and pipes and, you know, like, you know, there had been water damage and
not good for too much
trash of it. He couldn't rent it. So I grabbed a couple of young football players that their father was a friend of mine. And I paid these kids, you know, and we basically just cleaned that place out. It took us about 2 weeks to get all the trash out, clean it up, paint it. And then we went and disassembled each piece of Hammer. Carried it up through the, you know, like in the sidewalk outside the house. You know, they had those doors that open. We had to carry each piece, put it in a truck, drive it over, carry it up a very steep flight of stairs, and then reassemble it. That was my starter line. I started my business for less than $10,000.
Man, listen.
And the way I did that was,
these people out here now, they've got the ability to be able to start a business using nothing because you've got social media. You can literally be an online coach right now and people still create blockers. They still create barriers for themselves as to why they can't do it. You did it, having to fucking lug equipment left, right and center. Like, this is, it's crazy.
You
must have wanted it pretty bad. You must have wanted it pretty bad.
Well, I already had clients at the Society Hill Club. You know, I remember like personal training didn't exist in those days. It was no such thing. When I figured out that someone was willing to pay me good money to give them a workout, I was astounded. Because I would have done it for free because I loved training people.
Yeah.
And in those days, negative only training was like very popular. But the problem with negative only training is the trainer gets a workout.
Yeah.
Because, you know, basically for people that may not know, you help the person lift a particular weight into the contracted position, and then they lower it very slowly. The weight is basically too heavy to lift. It's eccentric contractions. It was very popular back in the 80s and 90s. So I would lift it for them, and then they would lower. And it was quite exhausting. So I started charging people $10 to do it.
Yeah.
So I was giving people negative only workouts for 10. But then people wanted me to work them out all the time. So, you know, back in those days, I was charging 10, then later $15. And I thought that was a deal of the century, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because you get to do what you love anyway.
And yeah, and I enjoyed giving people really good result-producing workouts, you know. And I would take measurements, and I had skinfold calipers, and I was doing all this stuff back, you know. Even in the 70s, I was doing this stuff, you know, just to track progress, you know.
Yeah.
And so when I opened up my own gym, I already had clients from the old Society Hill Club. So I had each person pay me up front for not quite a year. I forget exactly what I was charging back then. I think I was charging $30 a session at that point. But anyway, they paid me $1,000 each up front for workouts. And so that was my starter money.
Amazing.
That was my 10 grand. And
I'll ask a question about the because to me it sounds like you have well, definitely because of your nomadic, you're kind of like wanting your freedom. But typically the two go in hand when it comes to entrepreneurship and like doing it all yourself. Like where did that come from? Like, have you ever thought about why you pursue it all on your own and kind of wanted to build something for yourself? And where did the entrepreneurial traits come from? Because you definitely have them.
I always wanted to have my own gym. It was like my dream gym.
Yeah.
You know? And, the other thing that really helped, the landlord gave me 6 months free rent just because he wanted someone in the building.
Yeah.
And then as my business grew, I kept reinvesting the money in the business, and I hired a couple, you know, people to come in and help me with it. And before you knew it, we had this huge personal training thing.
Amazing.
And I had always wanted to have my own gym. It was like a dream. And then right about 89, I met the Gracie brothers at a seminar. It was the first seminar on the Eastern Seaboard of the U.S. And because I had been looking for something to replace wrestling. I mean, wrestling is a young man's game. Mm. And it was hard for a working man to go to the universities, because that's the only place where wrestling is, to actually train.
Yeah. How old were you at this point, Steve?
Say again?
How old were you at this point?
I guess I was like in my mid-30s.
Yep.
And I you know, I took Kung Fu, I took Karate, I took Muay Thai. You know, I tried a bunch of striking arts, but it wasn't me.
Yeah.
So I found a Russian sambo guy in the Northeast Philadelphia, and I would drive there. But man, it was, you know, fighting rush hour traffic. It was just, you know, even though it was only like, you know, 15 miles away, it would take an hour each way.
Yeah.
Stuck in traffic.
And for someone whose principles is to do something that's like quick and time efficient, this makes sense.
Quick and time efficient. So once I met the Gracies, I thought, this is what I've been looking for. I love this Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So I immediately got some mats, put it in the back of my gym. We started, you know, I just called up old wrestling partners, and, you know, there was an Aikido school next door. Some of those guys were kind of curious. And we started like a little core group of us guys working out. I was only using instructional videos at that time. And then I started going to California and to the Gracies themselves and training at the Gracie Academy in Torrance. And my first beginnings were actually in the garage. Orion didn't even have a gym himself. And then, you know, all the brothers that were together at that time. And then I just expanded. I rented the upstairs space, which was still raw, you know, warehouse kind of space. and just put mats in there.
Yeah.
And before you knew it, I had like 250 guys coming for jiu-jitsu. And I wasn't even qualified, you know?
That's incredible.
I mean, I was only at that point a blue belt myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kept going out to California. And then I started bringing the Gracies to the East Coast. Hoist lived with me for almost a month one time.
Wow.
And I'd bring the different brothers out and they would stay with me. And I would take lessons every single day. And my ex-wife was a genius with doing seminars. And she would book these seminars down at the Tropicana Casino in Atlantic City. And we would, you know, get 70, 80 people down there. So we, you know, we were helping the Gracies make tens of thousands of dollars, which made them eager to come out. And, you know, between going back and forth to California and having them come and stay with me and then have my own little school, I was able to practice just about every day, really, you know.
So you got quick, really good. Really good, really quick.
I was a very high level wrestler. So,
yeah,
you know, I had a blue belt in 6 months. And most guys, it takes like, you know, a couple of years sometimes to get a blue belt.
Yeah.
But I already had
good
the
foundation,
the base, the balance. Yeah. You know, I understood holds and techniques and, you know, and I had my purple belt in a year and a half, you know.
Wow.
And then, so it, you know, I rose through the ranks, but yeah, then I hit my, level of incompetence, you know. And stayed a purple belt for a long time before I got the brown belt. I had to win the, you know, won a couple of big tournaments and was promoted to brown.
Because you done a lot, didn't you? I mean, how long was you doing jiu-jitsu for?
I'm still doing it.
Competitively.
Oh, all through my 40, late 30s, 40s, early 50s.
So well over a decade.
Yeah, for sure.
A decade.
Probably about like 15 years I competed in jiu-jitsu. Yeah. But, you know, it's once again, the competition. First of all, I'm too old. There's no age category for me anymore.
It's a shame.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, most
fuck it. Just twist up all the young guys. Just twist them all up.
Well, you know, it's not getting so easy anymore. I can still roll and have a good time, but you know, you gotta be careful with injuries.
Of course.
At the same time, this jiu-jitsu business was growing. By the way, I had no business courses. I knew nothing about finance. I knew nothing about bookkeeping. I knew nothing about paying taxes. I knew zero.
Yeah.
But yet we had one of the most successful jiu-jitsu schools in the Eastern Seaboard. My wife started actually taking some business courses just so we could figure out what to do, you know? And we made a lot of mistakes, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of mistakes. And we probably wasted a lot of money. But
well, could you give a couple of insights into some of those mistakes so that if anybody is on that same path now, they might be able to avoid stepping on the mine?
Well, one of the big things was I realized very quickly that people are not committed until they pay their money.
Yep.
Once you get their money, the commitment level goes way up. So I started a practice of having people pay up front. They had to pay up front for at least 10 sessions for personal training.
Yeah.
And then we also had general gym memberships. And in the beginning, we were relying on people to come in and just pay us. Big mistake. People would go, you know, they always get late. Not that they're being consciously dishonest, although there were some people like that too.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
people,
there would be.
People that would come in and use the facilities or come to the jiu-jitsu classes. And this is just in the era before the electronic fund transfer.
Yeah.
Man, when we went to like credit card payments that were automatic, that was the biggest thing ever for our business. Now it's just common practice.
Yeah.
But back then that was all new.
Yeah.
And man, you know, we lost a lot of money because of things like that.
Well, the first one,
we did a lot of cash back then.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I had a couple of dishonest front desk people.
Yeah.
That were stealing. Yeah. And, you know, we learned the hard way that, you know, you got to be very careful about employee theft. When you have all that cash floating around, it's very tempting sometimes for people.
Well, I hope hope you wrapped him up and gave him a Kimura for that.
Well, actually, we quietly fired them, you know, because it was kind of our fault. It was kind of embarrassing, really.
Yeah.
First, we hired them.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we didn't do a good enough job.
Due diligence. Yeah.
Yeah. Our character assessment must have been way off. So.
Yeah, well, you concentrate too much on the jujitsu, obviously, and the level of service you were provided. I mean, one of the things that I will say is on the tune of kind of getting people to pay up front, you're absolutely right. And for people listening to this now, like as a fitness professional, you already know I'm an advocate for that. I always tell my clients, get the money in the bank. People are not committed until they pay. And there's a simple quote that I say is, those that pay, play. Those that do not. And I've always found that, like, the level of commitment once somebody takes the money from their wallet, purse, whatever, and hands it over, goes through the roof. Because they're actually investing money, something that they do care about, because they're earning it through X, Y, or Z. They care so much more now. Like, giving away...
They care so much more.
So much more.
We have a saying in the States, you know, put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
They talk about wanting to get fit and this and that. Well, put some money up. Let's see how serious you are.
Yeah.
And so many trainers, especially personal, have trouble asking for the money.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It's almost like this feeling of worthlessness, or you don't deserve it, or, you know, just poor self-esteem. But don't be afraid to ask for the money. And I never did free workouts. No. You don't get a free workout. I don't spend an hour teaching you how to train for you just to go off and never come back. Nope.
Yeah.
Right from day one, there was no such thing as a free session or a trial session. Now, I did have trial sessions sometimes for general membership where I wasn't working people out. They want to come in and just work out for the day of the trip. And I also had drop-in fees, you know, for people that would just come in occasionally. But yeah, the money thing was huge. But for that money, I had a responsibility. And that responsibility was to be on time. There's nothing worse than a trainer that's chronically late for his clients.
Yeah.
It's the quickest way to lose somebody. I discovered that the hard way.
Yeah.
I wasn't always as punctual as I should have been. I had people waiting sometimes.
Yeah.
And people will only take that for a certain period of time until they find a better trainer. The second thing was the service, 5-star customer service. You got to listen to people, what they say, the complaints, and you got to give them attention. You can't be talking on your cell phone. You can't be off, you know, looking around. You got to give them 100% undivided concentration during the workout. Mm. That's really important. And I have to tell you, our gym was basically not a fancy place at all. It was, you know, it was pretty rough. But yet we were like a who's who of Philadelphia gentrified folk.
Yeah.
I had millionaires in there. I was working out the owner of the Philadelphia Eagle football team. That's like, you know, multi-million, if not billion-dollar franchise. And he and his wife were training with me in my shitty little gym.
Amazing. Because of the service, because of what you were offering.
And work with me. Brad Pitt.
Wow.
I had people that were like, you know, like I say, who's who? Doctors, lawyers. They weren't coming for the facility. You know, so many trainers think, you know, because they don't have fancy equipment, you know, that they won't get. That's nonsense. It's the customer service. My equipment was okay. It was well maintained. It was good. But the environment was pretty shabby.
Yeah.
You know?
But I what you were delivering, it was what you were delivering where the value was. The value wasn't in the shiny objects on the walls. The value wasn't in the cool neon colored front desk. The value was in the fucking service, the stuff you were delivering to the individual that was purchasing from it. That was the key, right?
Yep. People got results. They got really good results because we worked them hard and we worked them briefly, but very safely. You can work out very hard But we, you know, we never, I mean, I think in all those years we had that gym, I can't ever remember injuring a client.
Yeah.
Not once, you know? Now, when I did start kettlebells, I started doing kettlebell classes. That I can tell you now, that was a step in the wrong direction. Not that kettlebells don't work. Kettlebells work. The problem is the wear and tear on the joints over time. Mm. That's what I found. I started feeling it myself. Many of the early kettlebell adopters here in the States have had hip replacement surgery, knee replacement, elbows, shoulders. I can name names of people that have had all sorts of joint replacement surgeries. Yeah. Even my ex-wife had to have her hip replaced.
So
she would find that one of the early kettlebell books for women, I think it was the first kettlebell book for women from Russia with Tough Love. She was the blonde during the single leg deadlift in the cover of Pablo's book. And she blames the kettlebell for her hip replacement surgery.
Well, I'm curious about something real quick, because hearing your story, and again, like, I almost feel like I need to get you back on another point just to kind of
unpack, we can do that.
More chapters, because there's such a huge amount of depth to not just your knowledge, but your story. It feels like we could just keep turning pages and unpacking certain parts. And so there was a time that you did want to be the strongest. You wanted to be like the strong one and do this stuff. But at what point did that change to longevity? At what point in your journey did a breakdown happen in your body? Did you have an injury? Like what made that shift?
Multiple injuries.
Yeah.
Some due to jiu-jitsu, but you see a lot of injuries that occur on the playing field. Like you've seen, like, on the soccer pitch, right? A guy all of a sudden pull up and his hamstring, and it didn't look like he was doing anything. It's like, wow, wonder what happened there. Why is that guy hurt? Or in gridiron football, like, you know, sometimes you'll see a guy, he won't even get hit, but he'll all of a sudden pull up lame. And you see it in all sports, tennis, whatever.
Yeah.
And that injury had been being built in the gym for months. Each workout of doing fast, explosive work, this idea that you need to explode with the weights to make yourself more explosive, or that moving the weights fast selectively recruits fast twitch muscle fiber, that is not true. And you do not need to move fast to recruit fast twitch muscle fiber.
Mm.
And it's not that fast training doesn't work. Oh, it works. The problem is the wear and tear. Each workout that many of those athletes do is like a subacute injury.
Yeah.
Not acute, subacute. So that they might not feel it, or they might feel something's a little off, but, you know, they don't pull up lame or anything. And each insult to the joint over time results in, all of a sudden, boom, the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah. Because you're very much more about, from what I've seen in the time that I've kind of followed your content and kind of you as an individual, I have seen that you focus far more on longevity, on being able to do what you do now to the way that you do it, but for many more years, for wanting to stay.
I think it's normal as a man ages too. You know, you know, we all get old and die. No one gets out of here alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was confused for a bit on demonstrating strength versus building strength. That's a whole, we could spend an hour on that. You know, just people assume that just because, you know, they can do a certain number of repetitions or lift a certain amount of weight in a particular lift, that's the same as building general strength. It becomes very specific, you know? It's so specific that a lot of the strength developed through big barbell lifts, for example, doesn't really transfer to other activities and sports. The general strength always does. But, you know, people mix competitive weightlifting with general training. A competitive weightlifter, like a power lifter, he's doing everything in his power to make the exercise easier, to make it more efficient, to use body leverage so he can lift more weight, because that's the goal.
Yeah.
For general training, you do everything in your power to make the exercise harder. Like the guy that stripped the weight off your bench press when you were young.
Yeah.
You're doing everything to make the muscles work harder.
Yeah.
Which means that you can't lift nearly as much weight. But that type of general strength is not only safer, but it has way more transfer to a sport like boxing or wrestling or jiu-jitsu or tennis or basketball or running or whatever. And it's more sustainable over a lifetime.
Yeah, I think you're right as well. Like, you know, I'm 32 and I guess some people would say that's young, but even my approach has changed massively over the years. You know, I've done bodybuilding, I competed, and I reached a point after that where I just kind of thought, you know what? What is this off-season thing, man? Why am I cramming calories into my body? Like, what am I actually doing this for? And I kind of segued out of that. And then I've gone down the route. I'm much more dynamic now. So, you know, I run a lot and for a lot of miles as well. I could do 20, 30 miles. And that feels, you know, I can do that in five and a half hours. I wouldn't say I'm a runner, but I can run. I box still. You know, I do some jujitsu. I kind of like, I've taken a lot from what I've learned over the years, and now I'm just about trying to be as dynamic as possible and as healthy as possible. Like, I want to live this isn't a fucking rehearsal. I don't get another go at this. So I just want to make sure that what I'm doing every day is going to bring me more life instead of taking it away from me, you know, even down to obviously the foods I consume. I've stopped worrying about muscle so much and started thinking about my gut, right? It's just a completely different shift in mindset. And talking
I think everyone's kind of forced to that eventually. Some people, you know, the sooner you adopt that attitude, the better your older age will be. It's like building your hill, you know? Most people reach their peak in their teens and 20s, and then it's just a general slide into decrepitude. But people like yourself and myself, you know, we build our hill like everyone else, but we're able to maintain that for a much longer time. It goes down for sure.
Yeah.
But you don't get this rapid
decline.
You know, I know people my age that, my God, they can't even get up and down off the floor. It's like, wow. So you have a slow decline. And then at the very end, you just die.
And like you said,
you don't spend two decades suffering, you know, and crippled up and sitting in a wheelchair or walking with a walker or being so immobilized or whatever, you know.
Such a horrible thought, isn't it?
I'm not bagging on people that are in bad straits that way. I'm just saying that we all make life choices and we do have a lot more control over our health than what we realize.
Yeah.
You know, it's all a discipline.
Yeah.
But I'd be happy to come back on. My time window ran out. I'd like to tell you about my nomadic years, the last 15 years of traveling the globe. And
brother, I definitely feel like that's a part two, right? We can definitely do that. Man, that is amazing. Yeah. I would love to have you back on, brother. And I knew that the time window was starting to creep to where it needed to, where you needed
to go. Yeah, sorry. I got some stuff coming up. Otherwise, I could talk to you all day.
Oh, definitely. We're definitely doing this again. I do have one more question. Keep it super brief if you can. But and I guess this is something that we could do on the next podcast, but I just kind of want to know now, kind of what is the vision and future for you of your story? What do you want to do? What is your mission and how can I help you with that mission? How can I support with Fit Story TV? How can we support your mission to help you do what it is you want to do? What is that and what does it look like?
Well, I am doing what I want to do. I do mostly Zoom sessions.
Sounds so amazing. I want to come to Greece and come and do some jujitsu with you.
Come. It's going to be the summer. It's very inexpensive for Europeans to go to this little island, Ikaria, in the north of GNC. That training camp is going to be end of July.
And I'm going to check it out.
Basically, jujitsu for a lifetime. Longevity in jujitsu.
Yeah.
You know, how can you play the game in your 60s and 70s and still enjoy it and not get all beat up and hurt? I'm pretty much living the life I want. You know, I, uh, I had a lot of changes. I had to pull off the road during the pandemic, you know.
Yeah.
I had a warning ahead of time. I know this sounds woo-woo to some listeners, but I've been using an astrologer for years who gave me a proper warning almost a year before the pandemic.
Wow.
I needed to get, because I had been traveling as a digital nomad for almost close to 14 years, I guess.
Wow.
And I was going from country to country, you know. I love coming to the UK, you know, Scotland, Ireland, Iceland, you know, Sweden, a lot of times in Norway, Denmark, Germany. You know, I've been to Russia 8 times. I've been to China 4 or 5 times, Japan, Bali.
Wow, man, you've traveled. You
know, Vietnam, all over Australia, you know, New Zealand. I mean, you know, Mexico, Central America, you know.
Yeah.
Brazil, 13 times in Brazil.
You got a place right here, brother. If you come to the UK, you hit your boy up. You hit your boy up.
I will hit you up, man.
Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure, bro. I said, let's get this done again.
I'd like to come back and talk about like how I set up my online business.
Yeah.
And now I was able to continue. I actually prospered during the whole pandemic when a lot of poor fellas, their gyms are getting shut down. And I actually did quite well during this whole thing.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of
I can talk about the transition, bro.
Yeah, a lot of gold for people listening on that one. So, brother, let's get that done. Let's book in another one. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you, brother. You enjoy the rest of your day. People,
thanks, Emil.
Story Fam, we are out.